Washington used to have a very particular kind of fantasy. When she left the house to go to the grocery store or the pharmacy, she'd think, what if I just turned around and went straight to the airport and bought a single one-way ticket to anywhere else? She never actually went through with it. After all, there was nobody who could take over as primary caregiver to her school-aged daughters or to her middle-aged husband, who at the time was suffering from both a rare and aggressive form of cancer and the disabling side effects of treatment. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The problem was never that Washington didn't care, but that all those exceptionally long days and nights of being the go-to person for every single need that arose left her feeling deeply exhausted, afraid, and alone. In short, she was burned out, and she learned the American healthcare system doesn't just benefit from many millions of unpaid hours of work from family caregivers, mostly women, by the way, but in fact that system assumes every very sick person has somebody willing and able to drop everything and devote 24 hours a day to their care for as long as it takes. Kate Washington is an essayist and food writer. She's dining critic for the Sacramento Bee. Her book is called Already Toast: Caregiving and Burnout in America. Kate, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this crisis for your family ironically happened at precisely the moment when it seemed like things were about to get easier. Will you talk about your life just before you realized your husband was sick?
Yes, absolutely. So I have two daughters. They're 15 and 11 now, but at the time my husband was diagnosed, they were 9 and 5. And so we'd come through the preschool years with my younger one, and she was actually starting kindergarten. On the very day she was starting kindergarten, my husband came to me and said, you know, I have these lumps along my jawline. Do you think I should go to the doctor? And I looked at him and I thought about the fact that over the prior 6 months, he'd been losing weight pretty steadily. He'd started going to the gym, but we're in our 40s and it was a lot. And I thought about those lumps and I thought, yeah, you should definitely go get that checked out. And at the time, you know, I've been a freelance writer for many years, and I thought, well, you know, we've made it. Our kids are going to elementary school. We have the stable childcare, a predictable schedule. My husband previously had been the chair of his department. He was an academic at Sacramento State University here, and he was going back to regular classroom teaching. So it felt like everything was just about to kind of settle into, you know, family life that would be, you know, still busy, but definitely manageable. And those lumps kind of upended that entire set of assumptions.
But it took him a while to be properly diagnosed, right? Initially, they were like, this is a sort of slow growing cancer that has to be watched, but isn't necessarily an emergency. That didn't turn out to be true.
That did not turn out to be true. It took about 6 months from that September first day of school until a February biopsy result that we got back. And we really had to push to get him assessed or get those biopsies. He needed a couple to get a conclusive diagnosis, in part because the cancer was so rare. And even once he got that that result, it was not clear what the treatment would be because of the rarity of the cancer. For listeners who aren't familiar with lymphoma, there are literally dozens of kinds, and they vary really widely in, you know, how aggressively they need to be treated and how aggressively they behave. So for a while, we really thought, like, well, this might not change our lives as much as you'd think. They were talking about doing watch and wait. But it changed really dramatically several months later. Actually, it was in May of the year I'm talking about is 2015, so it's been a while. All of a sudden, one day, you know, we'd had an ordinary first hot day of the coming summer. I'd been gardening. I'd grilled chicken for dinner. We were sitting down to dinner, and my husband called from the bathroom. And I was like, oh, what's happening now? Dinner's ready. And he said, come now. And I went into the bathroom and he was just coughing up gushes of blood. So I grabbed a bucket. It was terrifying, as you might imagine. I grabbed a bucket and we live pretty close to his medical center, the place where we get treatment. And I ran across our driveway and pounded on my neighbor's door and asked him to come over and stay with the kids because they were too little to be left by themselves. And I ran every red light on the way to the emergency room. And he was sitting next to me, still coughing up blood into that bucket. And it turned out that he'd had a tumor that had grown really quickly, very deep down in his lungs. So it had been missed on a diagnostic test, and that had ruptured. And he needed chemo really urgently. So he didn't come out of that hospitalization for close to 3 weeks.
How did you handle caregiving during the time he was in the hospital?
That was a real juggling act. And, I was fortunate to have family help after a while. At first, it was kind of get the kids to school, go over to the hospital, wait to see the doctors. And as, anyone who's ever had a loved one in the hospital knows, often the doctors are coming around on rounds and you wait all day. And the minute you decide to go get coffee or you have to go pick up the kids, that is the moment when they show up.
Right.
It's not a predictable schedule. So there was a lot of juggling, and a lot of trying to figure out the Byzantine bureaucratic systems of the hospital, figure out who was in charge, who to talk to, where to get information. At first, in that first hospitalization that I was describing, there was actually a disagreement between different services of the doctors. The pulmonologists thought it was an oncology problem, and the oncologist thought the pulmonologist needed to do more assessment because they thought a diagnostic test he'd gotten had gone awry, and so that it was primarily a lung problem. So even just navigating between the different teams of doctors who were disagreeing on his care was a lot of new experience. And that was really the moment I got plunged into caregiving, in the long, slow burn of the lead up in his diagnosis. Even though I'd been researching and supporting him and going to appointments with him, I wouldn't have thought of myself or identified as a family caregiver. But the minute I was in that car going to the hospital with my heart beating a mile a minute, I was in it.
Your book has really made me think about all the times I've assumed the crisis was effectively over for families where somebody's been in the hospital a long time. It seems like if they're allowed to go home, they're okay. This was not the case for your husband. What sort of information were you given about what he would need from you when he got home?
Well, there were a couple of different long hospitalizations, and I'll jump forward in time a little bit to the time after his stem cell transplant when he was hospitalized for about 4 months, and he came home really needing 24-hour a day attendance. And one of the big surprises of caregiving for me, and I think this is true for millions of families across the country, is that the care needs of people at home are often pretty high level medical needs, and family caregivers are tasked with performing, support operations that are far beyond what many of us have experienced. I had no medical background, and at different times, Brad, my husband, came home needing IV antibiotics, and I was trained by like a traveling nurse service to put that in his. He had an external catheter in his arm, so I would administer the antibiotics. He needed IV nutrition, which was also administered through a port that he had later, and this was after his stem cell transplant. And it was quite a tricky and complicated process to hook it up. And I was always worried about introducing infection, making things worse. He was medically very, very fragile. And there's this big gap between too well for the hospital and really, in some ways, too sick for home. I mean, it's best for people to be at home, but their care needs are very high, and often those care needs are not covered by insurance. So I think I had blithely assumed, like, if he needed certain kinds of nursing care, that they would send a nurse. We were very fortunate. We had great insurance. And so I thought, well, like, the doctors say he needs 24-hour care, there will be 24-hour care. And the shock to me was that there would be if I or family members provided it, or if we paid out of pocket to hire somebody to provide it.
Yeah, you tried to explain to the doctor, like, I've got two little kids to take care of. I don't have any training, sort of pleading for some other option. And he basically just stonewalled you.
Yeah, and I'm wary of criticizing the medical establishment too much because their focus is rightly the patient. They're trying to make the patient better, but often I think there's a failure to see the patient embedded in their social and family context. And so in the book, I use the term collateral damage to talk about how I felt like there was this kind of urgent battle to keep Brad alive. And I wanted that, and I wanted to be part of that battle and to provide that care. But the needs that he had were too much for a spouse or even me as his spouse, with support from his parents, which we were really lucky to receive, and support from our community. I had so many advantages going into this situation, and it was still just too much for me. I was worn out by the time he was coming home from the hospital. And the time he was coming home from the hospital after his stem cell transplant, he'd been hospitalized for all this time, and I was exhausted by the hospitalization. And then everything got far more intense once he was at home and needed care at home.
As I mentioned in the introduction, you sometimes thought about just running away. Have you ever asked yourself why you didn't?
Well, I mean, yes, I have asked myself that. And, I was able to take short breaks, and those provided, pressure valve. As I mentioned, my in-laws were helping, and they were often there for me to take those short breaks. And I think that kept me from breaking entirely. But also a sense of responsibility, a sense of duty. I made a promise in my marriage. I had my two children who depended on me and who were already honestly pretty traumatized by their dad's illness. There was a period during his stem cell transplant when they couldn't see him for a couple of months at all. And they were young and they struggled with that as any kids I think would. We're very fortunate that he survived. But I couldn't just abandon them. And so in some ways, my mental health at that time, my physical health and rest were things I had to kick down the road to deal with at a later time.
On top of everything, you worried that the fact that you weren't always delighted to have this role meant that you were a bad person. And, our culture really places particular expectations on wives and mothers to sacrifice whatever it takes. And you're not supposed to say how hard it is and how much you don't like it.
Yeah, I think that's really true. There's a very strong cultural pressure, and that is certainly one of the key lessons that we've all seen happening during the pandemic. I think there are millions and millions of women in particular out there who are tremendously burned out by the needs of care in their families, not just caregiving for the ill or for elderly family members, but for children. And there has long been a really, really strong, imperative to keep that behind closed doors, to say fine when you're asked, how are you, to self-sacrifice. My academic background is in Victorian literature, and it goes back to this idea of the angel in the house, the willing, helpful wife or mother.
So, in the 21st century, Kate, whether or not it's actually possible to make the workload entirely equal, the ideal for modern American marriages is that partners are equal in terms of like their emotional relationship. How did your husband's sudden and pretty complete dependence on you upend that balance?
Well, I would say it upended it completely, and that was not something that I had foreseen going into marriage, even though, one promises in sickness and in health, you don't necessarily think about the sickness coming in such a dramatic way at a relatively young age. The balance of emotional intimacy really shifts, I think, with illness. Obviously, Brad was fairly incapacitated. That was really hard on me. And one of the key things for me as a spousal caregiver, and of course, there are millions of differences among different caregiving situations, but as a spousal caregiver, one of the things that made it particularly hard was that I was supporting him, but I had lost my support system, you know, a spouse is the person you lean on when you're in crisis. And I was not able to lean on him because he was unavailable and ill through no fault of his own, but it was nevertheless a difficult situation for me to process.
One of the things you discovered is that you mentioned that you were occasionally able to get out and your in-laws could help. When you did have the rare opportunity to socialize, it could feel really awkward, right? Like your friends are talking about normal stuff, their birthdays and their kids. And here you are thinking about like your husband's upcoming stem cell transplant. And then when you did talk about it, their responses sometimes hurt your feelings.
Yeah, and I think I was in a particularly raw and difficult space. You know, people mean very well, but as so many of us experience in times of grief or crisis, it's hard to know what to say. And it's hard to communicate with people who are going through an extraordinary experience, an extraordinary dif extraordinarily difficult experience. And I was so consumed by Brad's needs, by his challenges, by the difficulty that we were going through as a family, that I often, you know, was extra sensitive to almost anything. And it increased my feelings of isolation.
How did your friends try to help, and how willing were you to accept that help?
Well, I will say that we did get a huge amount of wonderful help, and the practical help in some ways was easier than you know, the conversation and the spoken support. You know, it was easier to accept. We were the fortunate recipients of a meal train of people bringing meals. And there's a reason I think that bringing a meal to a friend who's going through a hard time is like a classic recommendation, because it is truly an incredible help and support, and it's literally nourishing. It's a wonderful thing. And you know, I never want to discount that help and that love shown to us in a really concrete material form. One of the most amazing things, and I mentioned this, I know, in my acknowledgments, is one couple who were the parents of our then 6-year-old's best friend just said to us, "Bring Lucy, our daughter, over every Sunday, no questions asked." And they hosted her for a day-long play date once a week for a year, maybe more. And that, you know, they didn't make a big fuss about it, but that was an incredible support that, you know, gave her a chance to feel normal and play with a friend, gave me a break from some of the more challenging parenting things and, you know, entertaining a 6-year-old at a time when I was distracted by my husband's illness. You know, we were fortunate to be able to accept some practical help, but sometimes I wasn't great about asking for certain things that I needed when people did want to help. I think we're all often socialized to be self-reliant. You know, American culture is very individualistic, and I'm part of that culture. And, you know, sometimes there is this pressure, both internal and external, to be like, "No, I got this. I'm taking care of it." So I probably could have, you know, made my own life a little bit easier by accepting or asking for more help than I did.
I wonder if there were things that you would have needed and accepted, but no, it didn't occur to anybody to offer them.
Yeah, I think that's probably the case. It, you know, some one of the things that stands out is a few times when people would text and say, you know, "I'm going to Target. Do you need something?" And those kind of like errands or very specific supports, I think are really, really helpful. Sometimes what I needed was somebody to ask how I was before they asked how Brad was. Even though he was the really sick one, it was hard often to always get the question about somebody else first. And I think it inadvertently had the effect of keeping me from being real about how I was doing, because I'd already answered the question about Brad, and you know, I was kind of the lesser priority. But you know, in my own situation, I think there may have been particular things that I could look back at. But what I would really love to point to is that I think what we need is not specific individual solutions for individual caregivers, daily needs, but large-scale systemic solutions and changes around this issue that can really support people in a broad way. I think there's a massive systemic problem around family caregiving.
Well, let's talk about that. After another very long hospitalization, when almost everything that could have gone wrong did go wrong, your husband came home. He needed round-the-clock care. And you, pardon the expression here, you were in the fortunate position of being able to kind of afford to hire a couple of people to come in during the day and at night to assist with this. You're well aware that many, if not most people, couldn't afford this, but you still worried, am I even paying these women enough? They're helping so much. Like, there is no coverage, right, with most health insurance plans for any kind of at-home care.
That is correct with most health insurance plans. There is coverage through Medicaid, but obviously there's a big gap for middle class families trying to get care for their loved ones at home. And it is a huge systemic challenge. There are 53 million family caregivers in America, and the number of hours of care that we provide add up to $470 billion worth of labor. And the challenges for paid caregivers and care workers are really an allied issue. Wages are driven down. The work falls disproportionately to women of color who are often in vulnerable positions, often immigrants. And so there's kind of a linked, I don't want to say vicious circle, but like a devaluing effect in general on what is actually really important work to support our most vulnerable citizens, elders who need care, very, very sick people. And I think it's bad for family caregivers, it's bad for the care workers, and it's bad for care recipients that there's not better support for those issues. And, there may be some policy change and hopeful signs on the horizon that I'm happy to talk about if you like, but it's a vast and I think has been an underappreciated issue.
Well, before we talk about, signs on the horizon, did you ever try to total up all the like the value of the hours that you were not working at your job as a writer, but were working as an unpaid caregiver? Did you ever try to figure out what that was worth in dollars, if it's possible to do such a thing?
Well, I didn't necessarily figure out the exact dollars of the deficit or the gap or how much I would have, made as a caregiver, but I did, take a good couple of years almost entirely off work. And so that was tens of thousands of dollars just of straight up lost income. I also, in 2016, the tax rules have changed, but we kept track of all of our medical expenses despite our, very good insurance. We had enough to claim the medical deduction. And so that was also tens of thousands of dollars in out-of-pocket costs, on care. And so I think if you kind of triangulate the gap between those, it's a pretty high economic impact. And our family is really fortunate that we were able to withstand that. We had savings and resources. But the economic effects on family caregivers and whole families can be really, really devastating. Lost wages, not just in the, specific period of care, but ramifying over the lifetime in terms of, missed opportunities to contribute to Social Security or to retirement. And so the knock-on effects over the course of a lifetime can be really, really devastating.
What are some of the remedies that have been proposed to make that better for families in these situations?
Well, the Biden administration really made caregiving and reforming care, kind of in all its forms, an important feature of its campaign. And they're starting to roll out different proposals for reforming different kinds of caregiving. changing the way we support and pay care workers was a huge part of the recent infrastructure proposal from last week. The American Jobs Plan, which would give, you know, $400 billion to better train and pay home care workers and close the gaps in availability for home and community-based services. And it's a really key shift to be thinking about care as infrastructure that we need to support workers. One of the key proposals is simply to mandate paid family leave for people. You know, America is one of the very few industrialized nations that doesn't do that. And it causes millions of caregivers to have to leave work or reduce their work hours with, you know, hugely devastating economic impacts because they cannot take leave to support a family member. So those are a couple, and I think there are more proposals on the horizon, including potential tax credits for caregivers and other things.
We should also talk, you know, you mentioned your daughters were traumatized by not seeing their dad. I'm sure they observed your stress and absorbed some of that. You were worried about them because as critical as your husband's illness was and as much as you were invested in helping him get better, you also realized they get exactly one childhood and you had to find a way to be present for them.
Yeah, that was a really hard balance to strike. And in some cases, I ended up prioritizing being with them over helping my husband. There was a case after his stem cell transplant where he got a second form of cancer, which is a whole long story in and of itself. And he needed to go across the country for a clinical trial in New York. We live in Sacramento. And I had the choice of either going with him to New York for the month for the clinical trial or staying home with our kids. And it was during December. It was over Christmas. They were in elementary school, and I chose to stay home with them. And Brad's parents met him in New York and supported him. He was still visually impaired at that time, so he really needed attendance and people with him to help him navigate, you know, an unfamiliar city. But I really wrestled with that decision because it was hard to imagine, you know, putting my very ill husband on a plane and not going with him. But I felt like the kids, after this, you know, devastating year plus where I had been distracted, you know, we had canceled a lot of activities they had normally done. I tried to, you know, keep them in touch with friends, and, you know, they went to school and had some breaks and tried to spend fun time with them. But those weeks while Brad was in New York and I was at home with them were actually really meaningful and a real respite for me and a chance to kind of reconnect with the kids, but it was a really tough choice to make.
I'm curious about the effect this had on your relationship to your husband. I mean, you had been partners, presumably, you know, went to each other with the stresses of the day and comforted each other. And then suddenly you've got to do nothing but give. And for the time that he was very, very ill, he could do nothing but take.
Yeah, that was really hard. I really wrestled with that. I won't lie, I felt resentful sometimes about that. I wanted that support of a spouse, that person to lean on, and, you know, it wasn't there, and he couldn't provide that. So the resentment was, you know, somewhat tempered by knowing that I was being a little bit irrational about that. You know, I couldn't expect that of him. But the effect on me was really real anyway. And I think he felt bad about that. And then in the months and years since that time, you know, there's been a real challenge of rebuilding the relationship around, you know, the changes in him. You know, he is now chronically ill. He lived through his ordeal, but, you know, with permanent physical effects. And we both were kind of changed by this situation over the time of the really intense caregiving. You know, I maybe lost some patience, though I like to think that now that I'm a little less burned out, I'm getting it back. And he had a little bit more trouble with initiative, being more proactive in the relationship. And so it's still a work in progress.
Is it something you can talk about easily now?
I can talk about it. It's still hard, and I don't necessarily have the kind of perspective from outside, because we're still in it. But we have been through couples counseling. He has read the book and has been incredibly supportive about that in an interesting way. Kind of bringing that to the fore and talking it through has been helpful for us.
Was it a surprise to you to take this quiz that you took and realize you were burned out?
Yes, it was. And for listeners who aren't aware, my book is titled after this quiz that I took after a doctor, told me you need to take better care of yourself. So I went home to Google about caregiver support and was led to a quiz about caregiver burnout, which I took. And at the end of it, the result popped up like, you're already toast. And it was very cheerful with this little like piece of bread all charred in the results. And the phrase just really struck me so much, because it also gave me these recommendations, like take a walk, have an hour to yourself, get a massage, and I was kind of dutifully doing all the self-care that I could squeeze in. And as I said earlier in our conversation, I was fortunate to have the support to be able to do that. And I was still just completely burned out, fried or toast, as the quiz would have it. And so part of my project in the book is to examine why this experience is so stressful, not just for me, but for millions of other caregivers.
I don't want to take anything away from the many men who are doing this work and doing it well, but is there some reason why the overwhelming majority of it is performed by women?
Yeah, I think that there's a long-standing, cultural predisposition to think of women as the caretakers, think of women as the default or primary parents in families with children. Care has long been kind of devalued economically, decoupled from the economic system. Family caregiving isn't counted in our GDP, and I think this association with women and femininity kind of drives that, and then it becomes a cycle. And I think that that's another place where cultural change and cultural shifts can really do a lot, not just to amplify the efforts of the millions of men who are providing care, but to also see it as not a feminine occupation and something that everyone needs. It's care is a human need, and it's something that we will all need in our lifetimes, and that likely all of us will become caregivers in some form in our lifetimes. And my hope is that we can start to see that as a priority for all humans and not a gendered kind of occupation.
You and your husband approached the worst parts of his illness with kind of different levels of optimism. It sounds like he was eager to see the bright side of things. You couldn't help worrying that he wouldn't make it or this would get worse. How did that disconnect affect the way you communicated during that time?
Oh, that was really, really hard. We often were kind of talking at cross purposes, and I was always aware of not wanting to bring him down, but also aware that I was the one who was going to have to deal with the fallout if something unexpected happened, or if, things did not go the way we had hoped. So I think we have that natural predisposition just by in terms of our characters. Like, I'm a planner and he's maybe more of an optimist. And for me, it was also exacerbated by like, oh, I really need to be the planner, because I need to know all of the contingencies that I might face in, be ready to support our daughters, be ready to, pivot at a moment's notice to do care. But it drove a wedge between us. It was hard to talk openly about some of the harder stuff. There was a long period where it seemed like he might not make it. And so death is a taboo subject in our culture, no matter what, and is particularly challenging when it's potentially right in front of you, and it's terrifying, and the difficulties around accepting that and talking to each other through it were hard.
Before I let you go, has your relationship to the future changed as a result of all this?
Oh, wow. That's a big question. I think it has. You know, it's given me a lot less certainty. You know, I like to hope that I'm maybe living in the moment a little bit more, but, you know, we don't know what lies ahead. You know, and I look at the possibility of more caregiving down the line, and, you know, try to just prepare for that as best I can. Right now we're in kind of a busy season of my kids getting older and thinking about in the future being empty nesters and trying to re-envision what that will look like. But this experience really called forth for me the idea that, like, all of us really need to be building caregiving and potential caregiving into our life plans. It's going to be a critical part of life for millions and millions of American families and families worldwide over the coming decades.
Kate Washington's book is called Already Toast, Caregiving and Burnout in America. Kate, thank you for making time to talk with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Ana Perez, Nilofer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Madison Hurd, Sriya Reddy, and Rolando Hernandez. You can listen to Think wherever you get your podcasts. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.